changes in Newton's methodology that make it quite a bit more complex than the usual hypothetico-deductive story, and that make it far more informative about the world than something limited to the hypothetico-deductive story would be able to deliver on. So I'll be going through these things. So mostly what I'm going to be talking about are the things that would be admirable features to get hold of in a Bayesian thing to have it do justice to this stuff. By the way, this is my first PowerPoint talk. So, okay. So pretty good, eh? No, no, so far so good. Okay. So the first part, I'm going to talk about the difference between the hypothetico-deductive methodology and Newton's methodology. The next part, I'm going to illustrate these differences with what I call Newton's classic inferences from phenomena. And these are the inferences that open his argument for universal gravitation in Book 3 of the Principia. The third part is going to be a general statement of Newton's methodology that he provided. This actually got published only in the third edition of the Principia. Newton, there were three editions published. And the initial reaction to the Principia by, especially on the continent, and by such figures as Huygens and Leibniz, who were in their various ways committed to what was called the mechanical philosophy, were that Newton, in the mechanical philosophy, the thing that people would try to do, the way you would make some motion phenomena intelligible was by showing how it could be caused by having bodies hit each other in various ways. And that was sort of what people would try to do. Now, Huygens, at a certain point, introduced a version of hypothetico-deductive methodology that was meant to do more than that. But the objections to Newton's theory was that it didn't look like one could see any reasonable way that one could recover, for example, the application of the third law of motion to, say, Jupiter and Jupiter's motion around the sun to have the equal and opposite reaction to the motive force on Jupiter, its mass times its acceleration toward the sun, its centripetal acceleration, to be the action of Jupiter on the sun. I mean, the natural thing to think of for the application of the third law of motion would be the vortical particles that are pushing it. And so this kind of application of the third law of motion was definitely objected to. But these philosophers bought the initial inferences I'm going to talk about. And Newton sharpened his methodology as editions went through, his statement of the methodology. And this was the fourth rule of reasoning, which we'll get to, contains one of the, it's a statement of the methodology that really articulates the role of acceptance in his methodology, and you'll see central features of it. And this is going to be the sort of thing I'm going to suggest Bayesians, I'm also a Bayesian, would be able to benefit by incorporating. Then I'm going to go look at the mercury perihelion problem. This is, of course, a very famous problem. And I will first look at the classic problem. And it'll turn out, we'll see, an American astronomer, astrophysicist, Asaph Hall, proposed an alternative power law. And in fact, the then doyen of predictive astronomy, really in the world by that time, Simon Newcomb, endorsed it as the only plausible, or as the one that he couldn't reject, and actually made his predictive theory compatible with Hall's hypothesis. few years later, this was in 1890. Well, we'll see this. Okay, I'll take you through the classical version. And we'll see the methodology that was involved in later work by Brown that involved getting reason to reject Hall's hypothesis and what the interpretation of the outcome of that work was. Then, of course, we'll look at Einstein and general relativity. And I'm going to argue there's been an enormous change in the last 20 or 30 years in history of science. Some of you have heard of the science wars. One of the things that Kuhn's work on scientific revolution suggests is that when there's a really revolutionary change, and one of Kuhn's paradigms of a revolutionary change is the transition from Newtonian gravity to general relativity. According to Kuhn, whenever there's such a change, the standards have also changed, so there isn't any way of objectively saying one theory is better than the other. From the point of view of the later theory, it's better, but you could. And I'm going to argue that on Newton's standard, the very thing we've been talking about, it was clear that GR would be doing better at that point. Then I'm going to look at, some of you will be familiar with the Dickey Goldenberg challenge to general relativity, Mercury coming up, the very thing that was the initial wonderful success, now is a threat. And we'll go through that and see the resolution by Shapiro's measurement with the radar time delay. The logic of this is exactly parallel to the logic of the Brown's answer to the Hall hypothesis. We'll see that. So this is going to be an illustration. This last part is an illustration of the methodology at work, continuing to be at work in general relativity as it was classically before. And that'll be the end of it. So I've put the really most basic version of the hypothetical-deductive model up here. Hypotheses are verified by the conclusions to be drawn from them, and empirical success is accurate prediction. Now, there are various versions of this. Some of you will be familiar with Popper. This would be pretty well all he would do. You'd be rejecting things that didn't make the right predictions. The more usual versions of it are ones where the empirical success would be leading to increases in probability in estimates of probability, would be inductive versions of this. But I've just put the basic one up here. Now, Newton's methodology adds features to this. It isn't like it's something else entirely instead. But it adds features. And these features, I'm going to be arguing, are really informative about the world and important and largely ignored, unfortunately, in most discussions by philosophers of science. And most articulations of even people doing the testing framework stuff, which I will be arguing is a clear example of Newton's methodology at work, when they say what they're doing, they make it sound like it was just hypothetical deductive. So the first thing that Newton's methodology adds to the basic hypothetical deductive model is a new and stronger notion of empirical success, a richer ideal of empirical success. Instead of just, it's not just accurate prediction of the phenomena the theory purports to explain, but it requires, in addition, accurate measurement of parameters by the predicted phenomena. And I'm going to be illustrating this in detail with some of these inferences from phenomena on how this is realized. The second thing it adds are an appeal to theory-mediated measurements. In fact, in this methodology, one exploits, insofar as possible, theory-mediated measurements from phenomena so as to give empirical answers to theoretical questions. You guys who are working, many of the talks we've seen about experiments are obviously doing this. There was a whole tradition in philosophy where it was where theory was a bad word. we'll be talking about exam. And finally, the third thing that's related to this is acceptance. Provisional acceptance of theoretical propositions as guides to research. So and this is the case where it's clearly different from, say, a Van Frassen kind of empiricism. And I'm claiming that, and of course, you couldn't even get off the ground with these theory-mediated measurements if you didn't have acceptance of the theory. And we'll see that Newton starts by accepting, in this case, the laws of motion, and then uses those to make phenomena afford information about forces. OK, so these are three ways. I'm not claiming this is the only three ways, but these are three important ways that Newton's methodology adds to and goes beyond the basic hypothetical deductive model. And I'm going to be arguing, and I hope I will convince some of you, that these three ways really do make a difference and make it a more informative methodology for investigating the world. Now, all three come together in a method of successive approximations that informs applications of universal gravitation to motions of solar system bodies. And on this method, deviations from the model developed so far count as new theory-mediated phenomena to be exploited as carrying information to aid in developing a more accurate successor. OK, so now we're going to the next part. I'm going to give Newton's classic inferences from phenomena. And we'll see how each of these illustrates this feature of having the phenomenon measure a theoretical parameter, so that the thing that's inferred is a certain value of the parameter, the one that's measured by the phenomenon. So the three classic inferences are to go from Kepler's area law for an orbit to the centripetal direction of the force deflecting a body into that orbit. The second is from Kepler's harmonic law for a system of orbits about a common center, say the planets about the sun, to the inverse square variation of that force. And then third, another argument for the inverse square variation of a centripetal force. If you're looking at a single orbit, the absence of precession is going to be measuring the inverse square variation. OK, let's look at. Now I want to be focusing on the systematic dependencies that Newton is able to prove, starting from the laws of motion as assumed premises, that are going to back up these inferences and turn them into measurements. So here's the area law phenomenon, of course. You're all familiar with this. It's the rate at which areas are swept out by radii drawn to the center of the sun. It's constant. So I'm going to now point out that the area law is going to be measuring the centripetal direction of the force. First proposition of the Principia itself, the laws of motion, this discussion of space-time, all occur before the actual beginning of the book. In fact, in his discussion of first and last ratios, his way of doing calculus. OK. The book one, proposition one, is that if you have a body that's being deflected from inertial motion by a force that's directed toward an inertial center, then the body is going to move in a plane. And the rate at which areas are swept out by radii to that center will be constant. So notice, if you were doing HD, right, that's it. Look, I see the area law. I can explain it with a centripetal force. There's the inference. Now, I want to suggest that Newton's inference is backed up by things that make it far more compelling than that. Second proposition, if you have a body that's moving in a plane relative to an inertial center, and the rate at which areas are being swept out by radii to that center is constant, then the force is directed at the center. So notice now you've got theoretical background assumptions that are getting the centripetal direction from the phenomena. But it's much better than it's even better than that. The corollary of proposition two, if the rate is increasing, then the scent force is off center in the direction of motion. And in the absence of resistance forces, if it's decreasing, it's off center the other way. So notice this is a very powerful way that given these background assumptions, which are coming from the laws of motion, you're getting this very powerful way that having the rate at which areas are swept out constant is carrying the information that the force is centripetal, that the direction of the force is toward the center of the cell. Now, all three of these are backed up by systematic dependencies of this sort. By the way, these are not just, for philosophers, material implications. These are counterfactual supporting dependencies. OK, Kepler's harmonic law. The planets so you have a group of planets. And if you take one planet and take the square of its period and the cube of its distance, the ratio between those will be the same for all the other planets. That's Kepler's harmonic law, i.e., t squared is proportional to r cubed. This is a diagram that a plot that Wayne helped me do some years ago. But this is we're plotting the log of the period in the time unit here is the time Newton cites for the orbit of the Earth. And the distance unit is the mean distance he has for the Earth. And we're doing, now Kepler cites periods as common. There's not very much disagreement about periods. In fact, the periods are, but there's disagreement about the distances, and he cites distances from Kepler and from the French astronomer Bouliot. And what we're doing is just plotting the log periods against the log distances. So here's Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. And this line is a 3. So to have the periods be as a 3 has power is to just have the slope of the line that fits those. To have it be some power or other is to have there be a straight line fit them. To have it be the 3 halves power is to have a 3 halves line. That is a 3 halves line. And notice the phenomenon, by the way, this is also another thing that's interesting about Newton's methodology. The phenomena aren't just data. Phenomena are patterns in sets of data. OK. The harmonic law measures the inverse square law. Here's corollary 7 to proposition 4 of book 1. So if the period is some power s of, if the periods, this is now for a system of orbit, if the periods are some power s of the distances, then the forces are as the 1 minus 2s power of the distances. And then from that, his sixth corollary, the special case, just follows immediately. You just plug in 3 halves for s here, then you're going to get corollary 6. If the periods are as the 3 halves power of the distances, that's equivalent to having the forces be as the inverse square. OK. So the harmonic law, if and only if the inverse square. But notice, we also have these systematic dependencies here. It's not just that. It's that if s is greater than 3 halves, that means the power law is falling off, is slower than the inverse square. And if it's less than 3 halves, it's falling. Oh, these are, OK. OK, that's backwards. Yeah, that's backwards. It's falling off faster than the square and slower than the square. That happens to be the right way. Sorry. OK. So you've actually got, so alternatives to the phenomenon would carry information about alternative values of this parameter. So it's way stronger than just hypothetical deductive. Now, the third one is the absence of precession. This is from Newton's system of the world. This is an early version of book 3 of the Principia that he wrote in a way to be accessible for popular audiences. For various reasons, not all of which are understood perhaps yet, he rewrote it in a way that only mathematicians would be able to read, because only they could appreciate the power of the arguments. And, but in this initial one, he makes this comment: but now, after innumerable revolutions, hardly any such motion has been perceived in the orbits of the circumsolar planets. Some astronomers affirm that there's no such motions. Others reckon it no greater than what may easily arise from causes hereafter to be assigned, which is of no moment of the present question. So if you could handle all of the precession of some planet by Newtonian perturbations, the zero left over would be measuring the inverse square for the basic field around the sun, inverse square force to the sun. Now, here's Newton's precession theorem. This is actually corollary one of his theorem. The theorem is stated in a slightly different way, but this one is easy to see. So if you, for a power law force, so here you have an elliptical orbit, and say to get back to the aphelion again against the fixed stars. By the way, in Newton's day, it was done with aphelions. Some later time, we started using perihelions. But you would get the, if instead of going 360 degrees, it goes 360 plus p degrees, that would be p degrees of forward precession. And of course, p could be negative, so you'd have backwards precession. So, okay, if there are p degrees of precession per revolution, that's true. Just in case, the force is proportional to r to the n, where n is 360 divided by 360 plus p, that quantity squared, minus 3. So notice that zero precession is going to exactly measure the inverse square. And again, we've got these systematic dependencies. If p is less than 0, you're going to have n less than minus 2. If p is greater than 0, you're going to have n greater than minus 2. So you're going to have the systematic dependencies just like the other. OK, now I want to, what we've done is to just give the basic inferences. The first couple propositions of the Principia are inference to an inverse square centripetal force around Jupiter from the motions of Jupiter's moons. In the second edition, he had enough information about moons of Saturn to add Saturn. And then proposition two is to get that for the sun from the motions of the planets. So you've got these inverse square. Howard Stein has a nice description of them, fields of acceleration around these various bodies. Now, when Newton was writing the Principia, Principia started, at least we believe, that when Halley visited Newton in Cambridge and gave him a problem, what would be the power law for a force that had a body in an ellipse? And Newton said, well, it would be inverse square. And Halley was really excited, because he and Wren Hooke had been arguing about this. Newton says, I proved it. And then he couldn't find the proof, he said, and went away. But a little bit later, this little text called De Motu arrived, and Halley saw it and was so impressed. It gave some of these basic results. And out of that little text, the Principia grew. So one of the intermediate versions of the De Motu text has this scolium, and this is probably what led Newton to this, was his realization that the center of mass, of course, of a group of interacting bodies isn't disturbed by the interactions among those bodies. So if you're going to find anything that could count as a center relative to what you can fix through motions, would be the center of mass. But of course, here's this thing. By reason of the deviation of the sun from the center of gravity, the centripetal force does not always tend to that immobile center, and hence The planets neither move exactly in ellipses nor revolve twice in the same orbit. There are as many orbits of a planet as it has revolutions, as in the motion of the moon. And the orbit of any one planet depends on the combined motion of all the planets, not to mention the action of all these on each other, but to consider simultaneously all these causes of motion and to define these motions by exact laws, admitting of easy calculation, exceeds, if I am not mistaken, the force of any human mind. This would have been sometime in, this would have been written sometime in 1684. And within, shortly after articulating this daunting complexity problem, Newton was hard at work developing resources for dealing with it by successive approximations. Okay, now we're going to Newton's Rule 4. So this is an articulation of some central features of the methodology. These rules are they're rules for natural philosophizing. So rules for doing natural philosophy. In experimental philosophy, by the way, Newton contrasted the name experimental philosophy. It's an explicit contrast of his methodology with the mechanical philosophy, where the thing that mattered was to get some plausible story about how it could be done by contact. In experimental philosophy, propositions gathered from phenomena by induction should be considered either exactly or very nearly true, notwithstanding any contrary hypotheses, until yet other phenomena make such propositions either more exact or liable to exceptions. And his comment on the rule is this: this rule should be followed so that arguments based on induction may not be nullified by hypotheses, undercut by hypotheses. Okay, so notice one of the things we see here is acceptance subject to correction rather than just assigning high probability and adjusting probabilities. So acceptance is really central to this. The second thing is the things that are accepted can be accepted as approximations, even if they're not exactly true. Now, Abner, we have from Abner's wonderful paper, the Scientific Inference, in which Abner puts forward what he calls tempered Bayesianism. He actually discusses commitment. And here's the commitment to a theory. Now, we're using H here. Theory H involves the belief that. So here's Abner. Within the domain of current experimentation, H yields almost the same observational predictions as the true theory. There's the approximation stuff that we saw in Newton. The concepts of the true theory are generalizations or more complicated realizations of those of H. And among the currently formulated, should be, theories competing with H, there's none that better satisfies the conditions 1 and 2. All right, now we need to say a little bit more about Newton's rejection of mere hypotheses, right? Mere hypotheses, you can come up with some other story about how it might have happened, but if that's a mere hypothesis, that carries no weight to undercut the inference. So in order to see how to apply this, we need to know what distinguishes what he calls propositions gathered from phenomena by induction. These are the ones we're accepting, at least provisionally, from mere hypotheses, the things that are not allowed to undercut. So I'm suggesting that what does this is Newton's ideal of empirical success. And now I've put this in a slightly different way than the one I had before. This is a slightly stronger version. Convergent accurate measurement of parameters by the phenomena be explained. Because by the time the reactions to the Principi are coming out, what you're getting delivering on is not just accurate measurement of phenomena by parameters, but what you're getting is agreeing measurements of the same phenomena from different parameters, from different phenomena. Sorry, same parameter from different phenomena. And that's what I mean by convergent. Okay. And a mere hypothesis is something that does not realize this ideal of empirical success sufficiently well to count as a serious rival. So notice how different this is than the sort of Cartesian approach to things that many philosophers of science today do. Look, if you haven't logically ruled it out from the explicit assumptions, then by God, I've still. Here, once you, okay, all right. Now, okay, so that was the little picture of the methodology and of features that we're going to want to have. Now I want to talk about the precession problem because it realizes this methodology at work before and after Einstein, as it were. And we'll see the methodology is working pretty much the same way before and after. So the Mercury precession is approximately 573 seconds a century. About 530 of those are due to Newtonian perturbations. And then you have the 43 seconds that aren't explainable by Newtonian gravitation. Leverrier in 1858 was getting about 38. Simon Newcomb by 1882 had given a more precise value of about 43, and that's more or less been holding up ever since. Okay, here's Hall's hypothesis. This is published in 1894. And applying Bertrand's formula to the case of Mercury, I find taking Newcomb's value of the motion, or 43 seconds per century, that the perihelion would move as the observations indicate by taking, okay, the power, instead of being minus 2 power, it's 6 zeros, 1 6. So he's got a little delta here, a little difference from the inverse square. It's this tiny difference from the inverse square that's doing the. Now, I want to say that it was, as I mentioned before, Simon Newcomb published his theory of the fundamental constants, theory of the inner planets and fundamental constants of astronomy. This is an articulation of the methodology that had led to the U.S. Naval Observatory becoming the place in the world for doing accurate ephemerides, that is, predictive models of where the planets would be. And a central feature of Newcomb's work that did this was trying to find a single consistent assignment of masses to all the planets and to use the different perturbations to refine those measurements. One of the things that Leverrier in those days, they would have a model for one, and they would actually use slightly different masses in different problems, and they didn't. But the idea of making a fundamental feature of it, getting at this, the accurate measurements of what are the causally relevant parameters, in this case, the masses. Now, Newcomb, I said, put forward that he discusses Mercury, he discusses the various things, his discussion of Vulcan and the Seelinger hypothesis, some of these other things you've heard about, is very good. It's really interesting to read Newcomb on this stuff. And he, but he says, look, I can't, this one, he doesn't endorse it, but he says it's of these that he's looked at, it's the only one that can't be thrown out. And then he actually builds in, and he says, to his explicit predictive theory for Mercury, stuff that will make it compatible with it. Okay, that's 1894. Now, oh yeah, the formula that Hall appeals to is equivalent to Newton's, and in fact, you can get this value. If you just plug in Newton's theorem and put in the period of Mercury and the precession of Mercury to get the precession, you'll get that number. So the formulas are in fact equivalent. Okay. So here's Brown. So here's Brown, 1903. What Brown had done was to refine Hill's theory of our moon's orbit. Hill was somebody that Poincaré admired enormously and actually said, what an amazing, and Hill developed the basic, it's quite complex, the gravitational model for our moon's motion, the Newtonian one. And Brown had it refined that sufficiently by 1903 So that this held. If the new theoretical values for the motions of the moon's perigee and node are correct, the greatest difference between theory and observation is only 0.3 seconds a century, making delta less than, and notice we're essentially measuring the inverse square out another decimal place a little better than another decimal place. So this is this second feature of the thing. We're actually treating this as a measurement bound on the inverse square. And it's a measurement bound that rules out Hall's hypothesis. OK, so that's as of 1903. And oh yeah, he says, it appears then that this assumption must be abandoned for the present or replaced by some other law of variation which will not violate the conditions existing at the distance of the moon. And notice, by the way, another feature. You're taking, look, the moon stuff as giving you the power law for all of the things. I mean, you all would have done this anyway, but it's worth pointing out that this is an important feature of this methodology that's there in the way science is done. And that's an important part of Newton's methodology, too. You take the measurement, the value of the parameter, and you generalize it and think it holds. In fact, I have an overhead about that stuff if it comes up. OK. All right, Einstein, 1915. GR does account for the residual precession of Mercury. And this is from his Berlin Academy paper. The calculation yields, this is his 1915. You may all, some of you probably know that this paper was written 2 weeks before he had the full field equation. And he actually got the result with constraints on what the field equation would have to be like. And this calculation yields for the planet Mercury a perihelion advance of 43 seconds per century, where the astronomers assign 40, I don't know where those came from, as the unexplained difference. Now, this is interesting. Einstein's reaction to this. You've all heard the stories about how Einstein wasn't that interested in the light bending experiments. And some of this is taken as though his whole confidence in GR was completely theoretical. But look at this. The first result was that his theory explains quantitatively the secular rotation of the orbit of Mercury discovered by Le Verrier without the need of any special hypotheses. This discovery was, I believe, by far the strongest emotional experience in Einstein's scientific life, perhaps in it all his life. This is from Pi's wonderful biography. Nature had spoken to him. He had to be right. For a few days, I was beside myself with joyous excitement. Later, he told Fokker that his discovery had given him palpitations of the heart. What he told de Haas is even more profoundly significant. When he saw that his calculations agreed with the unexplained astronomical observations, he had the feeling that something actually snapped in him. Oh, OK. Oh, good. OK, so I better get going here. Now I want to claim that this attitude of Einstein's was appropriate to these facts. I'm not saying he would have seen these facts just this way, but they are appropriate. On Newton's own ideal of empirical success, not some new thing that we get once we've got the new theory. On Newton's own ideal of empirical success, GR is beating Newton's theory right then, or at least given that the things hold up. So one important thing is that the Newtonian limit of GR recovers the empirical successes of Newtonian theory. Notice, and that means not just getting those Newtonian perturbation theoretic, whatever it was, 573 or whatever seconds. It's also these things that were so central to Newcomb that you're getting all these agreeing measurements of the masses of the planets. It's recovering all that stuff in the Newtonian limit. So it's the accurate predictions of the motions backed up by accurate measurements of the parameters. GR, of course, is overcoming the precession anomaly. And it's adding, for example, a new agreeing measurement of the mass of the sun, plus many other things. But this is it. So on Newton's standard, GR is doing better. You don't need a new standard and hence Kuhn on methodological shifts, like the choice between competing political institutions, that between competing paradigms proves to be a choice between incompatible modes of community life. Because it has this character, the choice is not and cannot be determined merely by the evaluative procedures characteristic of normal science, for these depend in part upon a particular paradigm, and that paradigm is at issue. When paradigms enter, as they must, into a debate about paradigm choice, their role is necessarily circular. Each group uses its own paradigm to argue, and that paradigm's different. So I'm suggesting, no, on Newton's standards, Einstein's theory is doing better, clearly. Now, I'll say, Well, now I want to, the Mercury, of course, came up again. In 1961, the Brans-Dickey alternative to GR, and by the way, this was inspired by Mach, it introduces a parameter omega to represent the contributions of distant stars to local curvature of space. Newton's bucket experiment, Mach said, look, what if the fixed stars weren't there? Maybe the water wouldn't rise in the bucket. Now, gamma here, the amount of space curvature per unit rest mass, is a parameter in the PPN testing framework. This is a framework for testing alternative metrical gravity theories. In the Brans-Dickey theory, the value of gamma is 1 plus this adjustable parameter divided by 2 plus that parameter. In general relativity, it's unity. As omega gets larger and larger, that's making versions of the Brans-Dickey theory closer and closer to GR. Now, starting around 1966 and going on, there were solar ablateness observations done that suggested that about 4 seconds a century of Mercury's precession was due to the sun's rotation, the quadrupole moment of the massive inside of the sun. So it turned out that a Brans-Dickey theory setting its omega at 5 would actually beat GR on Mercury. Notice, just like Hall's hypothesis with Newtonian gravity. Then a wonderful thing, it was sometimes called the fourth test of GR, the Shapiro radar time delay that was developed in the late 60s, and by 79 they were getting really good results with it. This is results that are, these are another phenomenon. The speed of a signal is inversely as the strength of the gravitational field it's in, so that a radar signal, say when Mars is on the other side of the sun, is going to be more delayed relative to the distance than when it's further away from the sun. And the radar time delay was measuring gamma, the amount of space curvature per unit rest mass, to be close enough to 1. So that any version of the Brans-Dickey theory that could be compatible with this would have to set its omega over 489. So it's ruling out any version of the Brans-Dickey theory that would account for this for extra 4 seconds that, sorry, less than 4 seconds that the 39 left, you get. So the Brans-Dickey cannot simultaneously accommodate Mercury's perihelion. That if there is a quadrupole moment that's taking 4 of those 43 seconds, you can't, a version of Brans-Dickey with its omega set at 5 would handle that, but it's not compatible with the Shapiro delay, which is forcing it over, its omega up over. There, by the way, is a another case of a phenomenon. Here's this pattern in the data. It's not just a single one. And I had a version, I have an overhead version of this, where I have the quote from Shapiro saying it's not directly an observable, but nevertheless, it's carrying information. And that's a, okay, now I want to end with 2 pictures. And this is essentially a comment on a wonderful talk that Lucian gave at a discussion. It was a discussion of interpretations of quantum mechanics. It was put on by PI that had Antony Valentini talking about Bohm types interpretations. Then it had Wayne talking about collapse interpretations. And then it ended with Lucian. And Lucian had these two pictures of Newton. This is the famous Blake picture. And this picture, you can think of Newton as sort of at least aspiring to this idea that it's all in there. He's outside of the world. You got everything in there, this kind of godlike thing. You think of the theory as giving you everything, right? And you're outside of the world. You've just got the whole thing there. The theory's doing it. And he contrasted it with this picture of Newton. This picture of Newton was done in 1870. It was actually in the London Times. And here's this more modest thing. He's in the world and he's finding out more about it, but there isn't this pretension to have the whole story. Now, I want to suggest that this always was Newton's view, even not just for his theory of light and colors, but also for his gravity theory. And my evidence for this is in one of the queries in the optics, he comments that one of the features of his theory is that you would expect stability-threatening perturbations to the planets. And so his theory, and he said this would, you could use this for an argument for God, because you would need God to have to interfere from time to time to keep the solar system stable. Interesting thing that he would even, I mean, the most important thing is that Newton did not see, it's Laplace later that saw this as the whole story, or the idea that these successive approximations are leading to getting the whole picture, and it's right there, and it's got everything already in it. This was not the way Newton thought ever that his theory would be able to do. It's something that really, I think, comes in the Laplacian period. I think it was Laplace's solution to the long recalcitrant Jupiter-Saturn perturbation as a periodic perturbation, which was amazing, that then led him to this picture. But nevertheless, even though you might not be able to think of and need to think about this, you might not be able to think of these successive approximations as something like, well, we can talk about, we're going to get there and have everything. You still have this methodology. These successive approximations are giving you successively better and deeper understanding. And that's really important. The two things don't have to go together. And the fact that you have problems with the ultimate picture, I actually think it's Blake is really reacting to this feature that he sees in this theory, this pretension to this kind of. The fact that you can't get that doesn't mean that you can't get more and more knowledge. Thank you. Okay, let me speak to that very question. Okay. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yes, there's, but let me give a, it, I think it's, part of what's, I think Newton's theory of light and colors also in his approach there represents another feature of this methodology that's very useful and interesting. And that is, I mean, as we saw with these acceleration fields, you get a theoretical thing. That's a theoretical thing. The acceleration field is like this. It's a capacity to accelerate things all around the sun. But it's a theoretical thing that we can get information about and do measurements about. We can get somewhere at it. And then, of course, you got to combine them all and you get, you know. Okay, with what his idea of a light ray, okay, was giving you some of the basic phenomena with mirrors and stuff. The rings are another story, but he was getting just to. But I want to get that that being able, what Fresnel managed to do was to show how the secondary waves could could give you a wave theory that could recover the basic light and cover stuff and refraction and Huygens theory, or Hooke's non-theory, but Hooke's suggestion, never could recover that kind of thing. And Newton's reaction to Huygens was, look, here the basic phenomena of light are the things that you do to make telescopes and stuff. And if they can't get that right, you would expect on the Huygens wave theory that it would fill the room. You wouldn't get shadows on Huygens theory. It's Fresnel that got, so I want to say it's not just the admiration of Newton and Newton had to be right. It's there was this definite advance that Fresnel made with the secondary rays canceling out that could allow it to recover what are essentially the shadow, all these basic light phenomena that got it. And it also illustrates another thing. The furniture, the ultimate furniture, isn't what matters. What you're getting are these measurement things, these, you know, you can have this radical change of the furniture and you're still keeping the other results. So I don't think this is a counterexample to the methodology at all. Sorry, why wasn't? I don't know. I don't have a. I think. No, I'm. What was. I should be able to answer that better. I actually think it is. He did discuss the rotation of the sun, Newcomb did, but he didn't think there was enough of lightness to give you a quadrupole moment that would. And it's really Dickey and Goldenberg that got the thing that it has to be, like, I think it was done with looking at the surface. You think of the sun's rotation as you look at the sunspots and you get more or less the rotation. And if that's the rotation, that won't do it. What Dickey and Goldenberg are doing is there's this inner thing that's rotating a lot faster that's making the oblateness. And I don't think they had observations of oblateness that would support that at all until Dickey and Goldenberg did their work. And of course, I haven't said about I'll leave that. I think that's what the. Yes, yeah. They were very impressed with the arguments for the inverse square acceleration, inverse square forces, and Huygens and Leibniz, all those people bought that. Where they dug in their heels, it's just where Howard Stein raises this issue about this application of the third law of motion to treat the action of the planet on the sun as the equal and opposite reaction of the sun's. And now the thing that back, I mean, Newton probably wanted a mechanical explanation of gravity as much as Huygens or any of them. But what was really different, what I think Newton's genius was following these measurement things and going with it and not letting the absence of, and not seeing how you could get the mechanical explanation undercut what the measurements were leading to. And that's what I think is really special about Newton compared to the other things. Newton actually at certain points did propose various things. And notice there's action at a distance, and there's also the mechanical explanation part. They're related, but they're not just equivalent. I think Newton was as sensitive to how difficult it would be, and he wanted that kind of it. But one of the things was that he's going with treating these motions of the moons around Jupiter and the motions of the planets around the sun as establishing the these different orbits are all giving agreeing measurements of what the acceleration toward the sun would be at any distance out. And you go with those measurements and combining, and then the problem is you don't stop those because they conflict with your preconceived notion of what it has to be like. In fact, his idea was that you would use these results to inform any account of any deeper mechanical account of the cause of gravity would have to be informed. These are the things that account would have to recover. It isn't like you know the account has to be mechanical, and so you're ruling out these things. And that's what's so special, I think, about what Newton's doing, is that he's saying, look, it's these features that I'm getting from phenomena about gravity that any account of the cause of gravity has to account for, rather than the reverse. I've got an account, and therefore I won't buy these inferences. And that's what I think was special about it. I also think that you would get people in the period, up through Laplace and beyond, who would be using this richer methodology, but when they talk about what they're doing, make it sound like it's just hypothetical deductive. Okay, thank you all.